Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue analyzing political corruption, its causes, consequences, and remedies. And first, did predatory developers use the law to confiscate thousands of acres from African-American families? Our next guest says yes. Leah Douglas is an analyst and a reporter with Open Markets Program at New America Foundation. Her investigative article, African Americans Have Lost Untold Acres of Land Over the Last Century, was published by The Nation magazine. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Leah Douglas. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the pieces that we wanted to talk with you about is the piece that you wrote about African Americans losing untold acres of land over the last century. You started your article with a story of a man who bought land in Hilton Head back in 1897. But now the family is struggling with the legal system to give that property to his heirs. Can you explain this, what happened and what the problem is exactly?
So my story follows one family, the Allen family. They're from Hilton Head, South Carolina, as they fight to retain their ancestral land, which, as you mentioned, was originally purchased in 1897. Essentially, the land is vulnerable to being bought out from underneath the family because it's owned as heirs' property, which is a very common type of land ownership in which there was never a will made in the chain of descendants who own the land. And so every descendant of the original owner of the property has an equal share of the land. The title was never written in a single person's name. An heir's property is vulnerable to being bought out through a legal mechanism called a partition sale, which basically empowers every co-tenant of the property to petition the court to bring the whole parcel of land to court-ordered auction. So partition sales have been a driving force behind land loss in many low-income communities, particularly in the African-American community in the South. So what often happens in these instances is a predatory developer or other moneyed interest might target one of the many co-tenants, the descendants of the original owner, for a plot of land and offer them a sum of money to buy them out from their share. And then once that developer is themselves a co-tenant, they can petition to bring the whole parcel of land to auction and buy it themselves. And so that legal maneuver has been used, for instance, on the island of Hilton Head, on that island to promote the expansion of hotels and resorts and other large developments. This particular type of legal mechanism is, some estimate, is responsible for about 50% of land loss in certain areas of the South in the Black community.
Let's break this down so that we understand exactly what happened. Let's use the Allens as an example. They owned a very big plot of land, right? But it's owned by a lot of different heirs.
Right. So in the case of the Allens, they own a 38-acre plot on Hilton Head, which is today the largest undeveloped plot that's owned by African Americans that remains on the island. And there are over 100 members of the Allen family who each have a claim to that land. So those folks are all descendants of the original owner, Dennis Allen, who was the original purchaser of the land in the late 1800s.
And then how is it that this predatory developer, as you called it, you said they convince one person who owns a part of this property to sell, and then that leaves the rest vulnerable? How does that work?
So this isn't exactly the case of the Allen family, but it's a common instance that has occurred in other families. So say there's a family member who grew up on the West Coast and they didn't even know that there was family land in South Carolina, for instance, and they could be contacted out of the blue by a legal firm or a developer who says, hey, guess what? You have a stake in this land and we're going to offer you $5,000 for it. And so, you know, if they had no idea, they might think, oh, okay, great, free money. What do I know about that piece of land? But as in many families, there may be actually that person's distant relatives living on the land, or there may be emotional connection to the land in another branch of the family that they're just not aware of. So that is a common scenario that's happened in many families. And then once the developer, whoever it is that bought that person out, has a stake in the land, they have the same rights as any other heir's property owner. So they can petition the courts to bring the land to a court-ordered auction. And there only needs to be, well, historically, there's needed to be very little notice of those auctions. And then the developer itself can buy the whole piece of land, generally at dramatically below the market value of the land.
You mentioned in your piece, too, that there are certain types of lawyers that play a role in all this. How so?
Well, Well, in the case of the Allen family, they got involved initially with a lawyer who was a well-known heirs property lawyer on the island, had worked with other families on settling heirs property cases. And the Allen family got involved with this lawyer. Some member of the family began to work with him. It's unclear if their relationship was ever formalized. But he was the person who initially brought the family into the court, made the initial petition to sell the land. That today, the vast majority of the family members say their signatures were forged or they didn't want to sell the land. They weren't alerted that the land was going to be sold. So this lawyer was acting without their consent is the allegation of the family today. But this lawyer had also, unbeknownst to the family, been leveraging his role as an heir's property lawyer to, in one case, you know, bring a family's piece of land to auction and then collect the profits for himself. He was actually about to stand trial for those allegations that he had stolen money from families that he was helping to clear their titles to their land and other heirs property related issues, but he committed suicide the day that he was supposed to stand trial. So we don't have his side of the story about what happened. But, you know, there have been instances that families have described, like that one where the lawyers themselves are corrupted, or in a small place like Hilton Head, you know, might have a relationship with a developer or some other interest beyond simply the interests of their clients that they're representing.
And how much land are we actually talking about?
Well, it's hard to know because there's not very many good estimates. The best estimate for the area in South Carolina where I was doing my research, the Center for Heirs Property Preservation down in Beaufort, South Carolina, which is near coastal South Carolina where the story is based, estimates that there's 105,000 acres in their 15-county service area that's been sort of in the low country of South Carolina and the eastern shore of the state. So that's just one section of one state, and heirs property exists all over the country. In any region where there are landowners who don't have access to legal services or low-income landowners, it's common for there to be heirs property because basically heirs property only indicates that there hasn't been access to will-making in the lineage of the land. So there's many, many, many thousands of acres, and it's unknown exactly how much land has been lost by a partition sale.
So in your article, you had mentioned that, you know, after the Civil War, that freed slaves and their descendants had about 15 million acres of land across the United States, most of it in the South. In terms of that number, do you have a sense of what percent ended up in this problem, passing it on to the heirs?
Well, in terms of exact acreage, it's hard to know, but it has been estimated that about 40% of land loss in the Black American community has occurred because of partition sale, and partition sales are linked specifically, for the most part, to heirs' property ownership. So in terms of acreage, you know, many millions of acres could be estimated to have been lost in this way.
All of the different factors that came into play, there's like a bunch of things that happened, it seemed like. Of course, there's discrimination. And you mentioned this systematic discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Walk us through these types of factors that came together and made this problem.
Of course, partition sales are just one of many structural issues that have excluded African Americans from land ownership in the U.S. And there is a very well-documented history of racial discrimination and gender-based discrimination in the Department of Agriculture's lending offices. And so throughout the 20th century, the primary way for especially low-income and low-resource landowners to access farm loans was through regional and local USDA offices, just their local elected USDA officials. And those offices were, you know, pretty much in the South run as sort of a good old boys club and were extremely racially exclusive. And the dynamics there very much mirrored the politics of the Jim Crow South and other racial conflicts of the time. And so African-American landowners as well as aspiring landowners as well as Native American and Hispanic and other racial and ethnic minorities were generally and often excluded from accessing loans through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And because farming is such a loan-dependent industry, it's really almost impossible to achieve any type of scale in modern agriculture without access to credit. And so many thousands of farmers were excluded from accessing, you know, from growing their farms to scale or even from owning farm equipment or lands in the first place because of racial discrimination. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has settled several lawsuits with class action lawsuits with African-American and Native American and Hispanic and women farmers to address those claims of discrimination. And there were other factors as well throughout the 20th century. Of course, the Great Migration was responsible for relocating millions of thousands of people from the South to the North, and was resulted in some land loss or land transfer, and also general phenomenon of industrialization, moving folks off of the farm and into the cities as well. So those are all some driving factors.
You were looking primarily at South Carolina, and you called it ground zero of African-American partition sales. Do you know what goes on in the other states?
Well, partition sales are an issue in other states as well, and there are active nonprofits and government initiatives to address, to provide legal services and assistance for heirs property owners in North Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, really many other states. And as I say in my article, the recent passage of the Uniform Heirs Property Act in about 10 states demonstrates that, you know, there are many states where, and growing, I mean, the list continues to grow where that law is being passed. And that demonstrates that there's a strong interest and need in reforming law related to heirs property across the country. My focus was on South Carolina specifically, but certainly this issue exists elsewhere too.
And have you found that there have been decent remedies?
Well, in my story, I detail the passage of the Uniform Partition of Heirs Property Act in South Carolina. And that's uniform law written by a man named Thomas Mitchell, who was sort of the preeminent scholar on heirs property. And it was really a big win when South Carolina passed this law because, as Thomas Mitchell says, the state is sort of ground zero, as you said as well, for partition sales and for land loss through this mechanism. And basically what the Heirs Property Act does is it provides some more protections for heirs property owners if they do find themselves in a legal battle of some kind. For instance, if a co-tenant, if one of the many heirs initiates the sale of the land, the other tenants have to be notified and given an opportunity to buy them out before the land can be sent to auction. The law also requires judges to make considerations about the land's sentimental or historical value, where historically they've only been required to consider its economic and market value. And that's really important for families like the Allen family, whose ancestors had been previously enslaved and bought the land after, you know, really worked hard to earn that land. And it means something beyond just the economic value to the family. So the passage of the Uniform Partition of Heirs Property Act in many states is definitely seen as a huge step forward. But until, you know, this is only in September of 2016 that the law was passed in South Carolina. And until that point, there had been relatively little legal protection for heirs property owners who were facing a possible partition action.
Well, one of the things you noted towards the end of the article was about the rise of ownership among African Americans of agricultural lands.
In the 2012 Census of Agriculture from the USDA showed that the number of farms with black principal operators, is their word, had risen 9% since 2007. And that 2007 had been the prior Census of Agriculture. And there's some discussion in the farming community about the USDA changed their metric for what a principal operator was during that interim. So the statistics are not exactly the same, but it still demonstrates that there has been a rise in ownership. And certainly the Department of Agriculture has worked hard to encourage and provide programs and support and lending for small and beginning and minority farmers. Under the Obama administration, they introduced a microloan program to make it easier for small farmers to access capital and have had some success bringing in low-income and marginalized farmers through that program. So there is some indication that land ownership is on the rise in the African-American community and in other marginalized rural communities. However, it is, you know, seen against this backdrop of, at one time, black farmers represented about 14% of all farmers in the U.S. in around 1920, and today as less than 2%. So we're still dealing with a dramatic decrease from where the numbers once were.
To conclude, let's tie this into the food economy work that you've done previously, where you essentially found the consolidation is really harming our food economy.
In my journalism, I focus primarily on consolidated business and how the rise of corporations and corporate agriculture has negatively affected folks in the food supply chain, from farmers to farm workers to distributors and to retailers and consumers as well. And so, you know, since the 1980s in particular, we've seen a dramatic consolidation of our food economy. Most commonly seen by consumers are big mergers in, for instance, the beer industry, or, you know, everyone's talking now about the Amazon buying Whole Foods, that type of major acquisition. We've also seen roll-ups in the tractor industry and enormous consolidation in the seed and agrochemical industry. And those types of mergers and buy-ups really affect farmers. And particularly recently, the National Black Farmers Association, headed up by John Boyd, has spoken out against the pending merger of Monsanto and Bayer, which is a German agrochemical company, and saying, you know, this merger is going to hike up prices for all farmers, but it will particularly affect less advantaged and more marginalized farmers, such as Black and African American farmers. So in that way, you know, consolidation can be seen as another factor that further aggravates issues of marginalization among African American farming communities, on top of already this historical structural oppression that community has faced.
Well, Leah Douglas, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leah Douglas is an analyst and a reporter with Open Markets Program at New America Foundation. Her investigative article, African Americans Have Lost Untold Acres of Land Over the Last Century, was published by The Nation magazine. When we come back, what corrupts society and what can remedy it? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What makes a society or a political system corrupt? And how can a corrupt political system be remedied? Two experts join us. Matthew Stevenson is professor of law at Harvard Law School. He's the author of Legislation and Regulation and the book chapter Corruption and Democratic Institutions, a Review and Synthesis. Miriam Golden is professor of political science at UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles. She's the author of Heroic Defeats, The Politics of Job Loss, and she's co-author of Corruption, What Everybody Needs to Know. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, both of you. It's great to have you here with us talking about a very important subject, especially seems like, from the American perspective, something that we should be dealing with very seriously, and that is the issue of political corruption. So perhaps we should start with, corruption's a word that gets thrown around quite a bit, and maybe we need to talk first about what it is exactly that you are studying when you study corruption. How do you measure it? How do you know it? Miriam Golden, why don't you start?
Thanks very much. Well, there are various definitions of corruption. The one that is most often used by scholars is the use of public office for private gain, which is a very vague and big way to think about corruption. It's probably better to think about corruption in terms of how we measure it, because the measurements give more information in some ways than the concept itself, which is very big. So there are multiple ways to measure corruption, but we normally measure it as some assessment of whether a public official is breaking the law for private gain of some kind. So, for instance, if a public official takes a kickback in exchange for some delivery of public services, that is pretty clearly corruption. So sometimes behavior is not, strictly speaking, illegal, but it still strikes most people as corrupt. So in the United States, influence peddling is not illegal, but most Americans consider it to be morally and politically reprehensible. Most people call that corruption, even though when public officials meet with corporations and take donations. There's nothing illegal about that in most circumstances, or in many circumstances. But people think that that's corrupt. So when we see situations like that, we would say that there's a conflict between what the public perceives as corrupt and what the law says is corrupt. As a scholar, I mainly want to use the law as the standard, because the public can vary so much in what it thinks is corrupt. But I certainly recognize that if the public persistently thinks something is corrupt that is not against the law, then maybe we ought to be looking at making the laws more stringent, for instance.
I think that there's probably a bit of that, too, because sometimes the law is not necessarily the best measure of what is appropriate or what is proper. I mean, certainly we had laws that were very unjust in the United States and many times in the past. Hopefully they get corrected. And some people would argue that the campaign system is legalized bribery.
Right.
There are a lot of questions to get answered within that process, for sure. So, Matthew Stevenson, why don't we bring you in here? What do you say about this?
I think my views are largely similar to Miriam's. I think one of the difficulties with this area, corruption as a field, is that term, like many terms, can mean different things in different contexts. And another thing that makes it difficult is it's a term both that we use as scholars to describe a phenomenon in the world, so we use it as a descriptive term, but we also, in other contexts, use it as an evaluative term to mean that something is bad or wrongful. And this can create a lot of confusion, and it can also really lead people to want to debate at great length the true or correct or proper meaning of corruption in ways that I think at a certain point stop being all that helpful. The term historically could imply a state of moral degradation or other ways in which the state had malfunctioned. Today, when people use the term, or at least when most scholars or researchers in the field use the term, as Miriam said, they usually use it to mean something like the abuse of public or entrusted power for private gain. But as you and Miriam both correctly noted, that definition has all sorts of ambiguities built into it. So typically, corruption implies some deviation from an ideal state or some standard of proper behavior, but there are different standards that we could use for measuring that sort of proper behavior. And traditionally, scholars have focused on three candidates. One, as Miriam mentioned, is the law. So maybe we could use a legal definition of corruption and say that corruption or corrupt acts are certain forms of abuse of power that are illegal. A second possibility is to use public opinion, general views of the public on what is right or proper behavior, and recognize, well, maybe there's some behavior that's technically legal that people think of as corrupt. There might also be behavior that's technically illegal, but that people don't think of as corrupt. And the third option is to use some other normative baseline drawn from political philosophy or a theory of good governance and suggest that maybe there's some conduct that might be considered corrupt even if it's legal and even if it's widely accepted. So again, we can go around and around and around for hours on these definitional questions. For me, the topics that I'm most interested in studying are types of conduct that typically would qualify as corruption under any of those definitions. So bribery and kickbacks, embezzlement, serious conflict of interest, and so forth, which tend to be illegal, widely condemned, and inconsistent with pretty much any reasonable theory of good governance. I mean, of course, there are going to be gray areas and blurry boundaries, but that's true of most of the words and concepts that we use. So I tend to like to just take that as my working definition and proceed without getting too lost in definitional debates.
You know, it seems like most of the, say, NGO types of measurements rely on perceptions of corruption rather than the legal aspect. And I can see that as sort of problematic, you know, with issues like denial or cultural acceptance of some things but not of others. Would you say that's a problem, Miriam Goldham?
It's a problem, but Not for exactly that reason, I don't think. It's true that most of the cross-national measures of corruption that scholars work with are based on surveys of experts or business people asking them how corrupt they think different countries are. So it's based on their perceptions of corruption. Most of the time, I think people have in mind whether they have to pay bribes to do business in the country. So they are typically, I think, thinking about illegal behavior. So the problem with the measure, I don't think, is that by and large it's measuring something other than illegal behavior, but that people's perceptions of the frequency of illegal behavior can be extremely inaccurate. For instance, business people who do business in a country are going to know if they have to pay bribes to get licenses, for instance, or land use permits, but they're not really going to have any ideas whether ordinary people have to pay bribes for the delivery of standard public services. Mm-hmm. That could be quite different. And likewise, the perceptions of experts are often influenced by what they read in the newspaper yesterday. So if there's been a big scandal that has revealed corruption, corruption might actually go down as a result, but experts might report more because they have just read the newspaper and said, oh, there must be a lot of corruption in whatever country was recently on the front pages.
I know you've both looked at various countries and types of governance and factors that influence degrees of corruption. Are there types of governance systems that are most prone to corruption? No, go ahead. Miriam Goldham, go ahead.
All right. Not that we know of. The countries most prone to corruption are poor countries, basically, and wealthy countries are less prone.
And why is that?
There are lots of reasons why that is, but in poor countries, public officials find it easy to abuse power, and the public is often not able to hold them to account. In addition, public officials are often badly paid and seek to increase their income by corrupt means. Matt probably has many other ideas because there's just pages and pages of reasons why poor countries are more corrupt.
It seems like it would be a bit of a vicious cycle, too, because it would keep it poor. Matthew Stevenson.
I think that's exactly right. You brought up a bunch of very important points, so just quickly on a couple of them. So first, I think we'll probably circle back in a moment to your question about systems of government. One thing I would say there is people have tried to look at the relationship between democracy and corruption to see if more democratic countries, where presumably voters can hold politicians accountable, are less corrupt. And the answer in terms of just the correlations, again, using these perception measures, which Miriam rightly points out have a lot of problems, suggests that even if you control for countries' wealth, its per capita income, countries that have been very democratic for a very long time seem to have lower levels of perceived corruption than do other countries. But beyond that, there doesn't seem to be a terribly strong or really any consistent correlation between democracy and lower perceived corruption levels. So new democracies, partial democracies, not fully institutionalized democracies don't seem to perform much better on average than authoritarian systems. The other thing it's important to recognize there is even though that statistical tendency that I just described is I think, there in the data, there's huge amounts of variation. There are both autocracies and democracies with both very high and very low levels of corruption. With respect to the point about wealth and corruption, you know, the point that you just made about vicious cycles is, I think, absolutely right, and it applies in other areas as well. One of the big challenges with addressing the problem of corruption is that in many situations, it can become self-reinforcing. So there are many people who believe, based on, I think, some pretty decent research, as we were just discussing, that poor countries tend to be more corrupt for many of the reasons that Miriam was laying out. Also, it just takes resources to do things like not only pay your civil servants, but to have a well-functioning law enforcement system, to have trained auditors, and so on and so forth. Many people also believe that more corrupt countries tend to stay poorer for a variety of reasons. Again, corruption can act as a tax, but a particularly inefficient tax on businesses, driving would-be entrepreneurs into the underground economy or into various inefficient forms of public service. It can have all sorts of other effects like that. So you do get these vicious cycles. You get those vicious cycles in other respects as well. Some of them aren't economic as much as they are psychological or moral. So many people believe, and again, there's research to support this, that people are more likely to behave in a corrupt manner when they believe that corruption is very widespread in their community or society or government agency, in part because they're less likely to get caught when there are a lot of people doing it, in part because the sense of shame or guilt that one feels behaving corruptly is likely to be lower when everyone else does it, where when you're in an environment where people tend to follow the rules and behave non-corruptly, people will feel more shame or guilt if they deviate from those norms. And again, that means you can get these vicious or virtuous cycles. Both a state of integrity and a state of corruption can be self-reinforcing.
So that brings in the whole question around cultures of corruption, which Miriam Goldham, you talked about in your book. So what do we mean, and how does this relate to what Matt was just telling us?
So by cultures of corruption, we in part mean exactly what Matt just was referring to, the expectation that everybody else around you is paying or taking bribes, or conversely, the expectation that you can't get away with that in the culture that you're in. So that is part of what we mean by cultures of corruption, and what maybe a large part. One thing that's interesting about these cultures of corruption is that they don't seem to correspond to other aspects of culture that we may think about. So, for instance, any religion can be corrupt or not corrupt, as far as we know, and any ethnic group. And we find corruption on every continent on the planet, except maybe Antarctica, as far as we know. So corruption doesn't seem to be located in any particular culture in that sense of culture, in religious or ethnic terms, for instance.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about the causes and consequences of political corruption. So can a culture or country or system that has been mired in a really corrupt way of doing things transform? Have we seen that?
One way to think about the answer to that question is to recognize that the state of lower corruption or corruption under control, again, no society has eliminated corruption, but if you think we have some societies in the world where corruption is a problem that is under control and isn't completely endemic throughout the political system, those societies must have gone through the transition you just described, because a situation of what we might think of as endemic corruption is the norm throughout human history. And these countries that often score very well on these perception indexes that we were discussing earlier, principally in places like North America, Western Europe, places like that, these are all places that in the not too distant past were mired in the same kind of systematic government corruption that now continues to characterize many other parts of the world. So all of those societies went through a transition of this sort. And that observation also, I think, really amplifies an important point that Miriam was just making, which is that when we talk about cultures of corruption, we're not talking about, or cultures of integrity, deep-seated, unchanging cultural norms that have been around for hundreds of years or longer. If you look at or if you read about what Sweden was like at the turn of the 19th century, the Swedish state was thoroughly corrupt. Same could be said of Denmark. Finland, I gather, as late as the 1940s or 50s, the British government was warning British business to be careful about doing business in Finland because the political corruption was so bad. If you look at the United States, the substantial transformation, it's a long-term process, but it really it's between the period roughly following the end of the Civil War up through about the 1930s or 40s or so, where obviously there's still corruption into that period, but there's just a really quite substantial change. So yes, I think there's a lot of evidence that societies can make this transition. We're still stumbling around in the dark a little bit to understand why it happens sometimes and not others, what sorts of things can make it more or less likely. But in terms of whether it can happen, yes, obviously it can. It has over and over again.
Well, that was going to be my next question, was how. And so I wonder if you could take apart one of those examples that you gave, you know, whether it's, you know, Sweden or Denmark or Finland or the United States, like what happened that had it turn around?
Again, I said we're stumbling around in the dark a little bit on this because a lot of things happened and it's hard to tell what were the main drivers, what were the causes, what were the effects. And the story in different countries is likely to be different, but there do seem to be a few ingredients that may make a difference. So in some of these situations, there's a sense of urgency brought on sometimes by external events. This is maybe a little bit less the story in the United States, but based on what I've read, I'm certainly no expert in Swedish history, but based on my limited reading, military defeats really kind of shocked the Swedes in the 19th century into the sense that their state wasn't functioning very well. So sometimes there can be that external shock. Sometimes changes in media or media technology may have an effect. So there's been some very interesting historical work on the United States that suggests that factors as seemingly marginal as the declining price of newsprint may have substantially affected the economics of the newspaper industry in urban settings in the United States between the late 19th and early 20th century, introducing more competition and more newspapers funded by advertising rather than political parties, which changed the nature of coverage. Now, there may be some contemporary resonance, although it's hard to figure out exactly how with respect to modern internet technology, but certainly changes in media technology may have had something to do with it. In the United States, of course, there were sustained political movements, the progressives and so forth, that were pushing for not just, strictly speaking, anti-corruption reforms, but broader reforms to the civil service, the promotion of a more meritocratic, more politically neutral bureaucracy. That's also something we seem to see in some of the other cases, like Sweden. Civil service reform more broadly is a big part of anti-corruption reform. So those seem to be quite significant. Many people believe in the United States that, although this would be a more of a factor that's particular to certain countries, the federal structure, and in particular the fact that you could have the federal government and federal prosecutors addressing state and local corruption, may have been a quite significant factor. So those may all have been contributors. In the more modern so-called success stories, or at least the countries that people sometimes highlight as success stories, those would tend to include countries or jurisdictions, I should say, like Hong Kong, Singapore, Botswana, more recently places perhaps like Georgia. One of the things that's the country, I mean, not the state, one of the things that may be striking and maybe slightly troubling about some of those examples is that they tended to involve, on the one hand, maybe more rapid progress, but on the other hand, progress initiated and sustained by largely unconstrained and not so much directly politically accountable chief executives. Hong Kong and Singapore really, really not terribly accountable. Georgia and Botswana a little bit more complicated because you did get elected leaders, but in Botswana it was essentially a one-party state at the relevant time, and in Georgia you got a very powerful president without very many constraints on his power. So that does raise some concerns that for countries that want to see more rapid forms of success, I mean, you know, it's a little bit troubling that some of those modern cases, as opposed to more historical cases, seem to involve relaxations of checks and balances that we might think of as really valuable for other reasons.
Miriam Golden, what would you say to that?
I would certainly agree with everything that Matt has said. One thing I would, I guess, add is that occasionally, not very often, but occasionally, we do also see voters really rise up and switch their party affiliations and simply vote for new parties and new candidates, ejecting from office political elites that are known to be corrupt and have been corrupt for many decades. But there are times in some countries where voters become thoroughly disgusted by corruption and where they sense that they have the opportunity to coordinate their behavior and switch to new and potentially less corrupt politicians. So I would say that in countries that are now becoming somewhat wealthier, where there's a new middle class, such as Brazil and much of and Mexico and much of Latin America, India as well, we increasingly see middle-class anti-corruption movements often working in alliance with the judiciary and the press to really try to make progress in cleaning up corruption as the middle class becomes increasingly disaffected with the kind of governance that their country has been enjoying for decades and decades.
What about the other way, where you have perhaps a meritocratic system, a system that is, you know, pretty honest, pretty above board, rule of law, and it goes the other direction? Do we see that very often, Matt Stevenson?
I'm sure that we do. I'm sure it wouldn't be hard to find examples of certainly particular, you know, agencies or departments that have gone backwards. Yeah, I mean, I'm not. Great examples are not leaping immediately to mind, but that's more just because I'm having a mental block, and maybe Miriam can jump in with some good examples. But I'm sure that has to happen sometimes. I mean, none of these things are guaranteed, and the virtuous vicious cycle dynamic that we were talking about before means that it means actually two things. So one is I'm more optimistic, one is more pessimistic. The more optimistic is that it's the flip side of what makes corruption so hard to tackle. Systems with integrity might have a certain degree of resilience, at least for a while. The more pessimistic read on this is that once the degeneration passes a certain point, you can really get into a state of collapse because the good people start leaving. People of integrity start leaving when they feel like an organization's really falling into corruption, and shame and guilt really start to deteriorate as well. I think in the private sector, there are probably all sorts of examples of this where a company that maybe for a while functioned with a certain degree of integrity, maybe under bad leadership or what have you, degenerates. I'm not off the top of my head coming with great country examples, which maybe should be encouraging, but I'm sure they're out there, unfortunately.
Miriam Golden?
Well, so even in relatively clean countries, you can have cultures of corruption that are localized. So, for instance, the United States is not the world's least corrupt country, but it's one of the less corrupt countries in the world, certainly. But even in the United States, there are certain cultures of corruption. I guess it was the pension plan in the trains in New York State or something that were, I mean, or certain police forces or certain parts of the construction industry. So there are certain industries in some localities that might be very corrupt, even though on the whole, people in the United States don't have to pay bribes for public services, and corruption of that sort in particular is relatively limited. What we don't see, and I think Matt is right about this, we don't see countries that have become pretty honest and have created a culture of integrity that is relatively persistent. We do not see those countries, or we have not seen those countries, suddenly collapse into wholesale corruption. Historically, as far as I know, there aren't instances of that. So the countries that have become wealthier have gradually cleaned up corruption, and have not overall gone backwards. But of course, you can still uncover cultures of corruption in particular sectors, even in the most honest countries in the world. Could the United States collapse and become a highly corrupt country the way that it used to be? And the answer is, well, we don't know, because we don't think that that's happened before.
What I was going to add to that, I think I agree. There are examples of countries that had seemed to be making some progress and then seemed to be maybe moving in the wrong direction. So that's different from Miriam's correct observation. At least I can't think of examples of countries that had really made what you can think of as a full transition to a relatively, again, this is all relative, low corruption society that switched back. But I would say South Africa is a country that certainly under President Zuma, we've seen movement in not the direction we would have liked to see. Malaysia is a country that I think people thought was moving more in the right direction, that had, for example, an anti-corruption commission that was very well regarded within the region, that then turned out to be entirely powerless, essentially, in the face of the most recent scandals there, the so-called 1MDB scandal. But there are some other countries that had seemed to have made that full transition that people are at least worried about. One, and maybe this is what Miriam was alluding to, is the United States, where we're in a kind of new situation with respect to these issues in the U.S. federal government than we had been before. I personally don't think we're going to collapse back into a state where things look like they did in 1870, but I certainly have many more concerns about systemic corruption and the change of norms of integrity in the U.S. federal government than I have before. And Hong Kong is another, and that may be driven by the rather unique status that Hong Kong has formerly as a British colony and now as part of China, but one that has a special status. I'm certainly no expert, but I travel to that part of the world with some frequency, and I have friends who observe it pretty closely, and at least the people I talk to are quite concerned that maybe it won't change with respect to people not having to pay bribes on a day-to-day basis, but people are certainly voicing concerns that corruption and conflict of interest and relationship-based dealing and a variety of other unsavory kinds of corrupt or quasi-corrupt practices are already starting to make a comeback under Chinese rule.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about the causes and consequences of political corruption. You know, a couple of the examples that you gave, one was the transition from Mandela, who seemed to run a very clean South Africa, to Zuma. That might be one that has kind of gone the wrong direction. So it seems like leadership really does matter. And that brings up the point that Miriam Golden mentioned, which is, yeah, what about the United States? It seems like the person at the head of the government is not as concerned about ethics and public interest and does have some what look like conflicts of interest, to my eye at least.
You know, I think that's true, but I have to say that those are actually not my biggest concerns with Trump. I think that he does have conflicts of interest, but I'm much more concerned that he is not respectful of the rule of law, that he basically doesn't appear to subscribe to the norms of democracy, than I am concerned that he's profiteering while holding office, which he may also be doing.
Matt Stevenson?
I think my perspective is maybe slightly but not dramatically different, and I guess the way I would put it is this. So first, I don't want to come off as a paranoid or hysteric. I don't think that we're on the verge, as I said before, of a complete collapse, and indeed there have been some encouraging signs that other aspects of U.S. institutions are resisting and that certain norms of integrity seem to be holding up. But where I might have a slight difference of perspective from Miriam is, although I entirely share her view that the apparent lack of respect for the rule of law is a much more serious concern than the apparent profiteering, one of the reasons that I was so concerned about the conflict of interest and profiteering issues right from the get-go is I have this instinctive sense that those things are related, that it's all part of one big thing. And I guess part of the reason I had that reaction is that although the Trump phenomenon, what we're seeing in the United States right now, particularly with respect to these issues, is a new experience, at least in my lifetime in the United States, it's not actually that new an experience in the world. And so many aspects of Trump, including in this area, seemed not identical to, but strongly reminiscent of leaders like Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, Thaksin Shinawatra in Thailand, Joseph Estrada in the Philippines, Jacob Zuma, who we were just talking about in South Africa, Nestor and Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, and the list could go on and on. So in some sense, the focus that Trump and the Trump family seem to have on their personal enrichment was for me a warning sign, even though it may not be the most important thing. And that attitude towards government, that public service is a way to advance oneself materially or otherwise, I think is one of the drivers, or at least contributing factors to the broader contempt for norms and the rule of law that Miriam is rightly concerned about and more concerned about. So, I don't think this is a strong disagreement with Miriam's perspective. I certainly agree with her on the relative significance of the problem. But for me, one of the things that makes me nervous, it makes me nervous about seemingly trivial things like those reports that, you know, the Trump hotels hired someone to try to get more diplomats to book events at the Trump D.C. hotel, is that it just feels like part of one big thing, and that, to put this in the terminology of actually a South African former official who I was talking to a little bit earlier today, we've seen this movie before.
And so if we were going to turn to remedies, what are the policies, the legal perspectives, the ways to make a system less corrupt? Miriam Golden, what do you think?
I think that there are lots of kinds of remedies that are used in different contexts. Auditing government officials, monitoring and auditing their behavior and their expenses is a pretty common kind of remedy that is put in place and that is often quite helpful in reducing corruption. One thing we haven't mentioned is that the laws that exist right now across the world are pretty similar in terms of what gets classed as corruption. So it's illegal to buy votes almost everywhere in the world. It's illegal to take a bribe to do your job if you're a government official everywhere in the world. So the basic laws on the books are pretty much the same. The enforcement of those laws varies a great deal. And so monitoring and auditing whether the laws are enforced makes a really big difference, and I think that might be perhaps the single most effective thing that can be done.
And would you agree, Matt Stevenson?
I would. You know, one of the things about this area is that, for understandable reasons, a lot of the time people, both researchers and people out there working on policy reform and advocacy, are looking for new ideas, silver bullets, thinking outside the box is a phrase that you hear a lot, probably too much. And I'm all for innovation. I think a lot of that is really good. I mean, one of the things that we've seen come on the policy agenda much more just in the last decade or so is focusing on asset seizure, asset recovery, following the money, visa ban. So I'm all for innovation. I think that's terrific. But I actually think that, you know, 85 to 90% of the policy measures that one would need to make significant progress against corruption, we basically already know, and Miriam, I think, quite effectively outlined the main ones. We need auditing, we need monitoring, we need laws on the books that are also effectively and vigorously enforced. We need them to be enforced by law enforcement agencies, investigators, prosecutors, and so forth, that have sufficient operational independence while also being sufficiently insulated. We need an appropriate degree of transparency. We need a court system that has integrity, and so forth. So the problem isn't really figuring out what we need to do. It's figuring out how we can do it and sustain our efforts over time. So the maybe kind of silly analogy or metaphor that I sometimes like to use on this, which is increasingly meaningful to me with every passing year, is if you want to lose weight, right, if you want to get your weight down to a healthy level, we basically know 85 to 90% of what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to eat a sensible diet with, you know, lots of grains and vegetables and not too much meat or sugar, supplemented with exercise. And, you know, every year the diet book industry is coming out with new ideas that are essentially the thinking outside the box or the new thinking of the silver bullets, the zone diet, the South Beach diet, the paleo diet, the whatever. But actually, that's all fine and good, but really what you need to do is, we know what we need to do. The question is, just like with sustaining a healthy diet and supplementing with exercise, how do you sustain it over a long enough period of time to really make a meaningful difference? Because one of the features of this vicious cycle dynamic that we were talking about before, and that Miriam goes into so effectively in her recent book with her co-author Ray Fisman, is that measures that are not sustained are not likely to be sufficient to shift societies out of this bad state where corruption becomes self-reinforcing to a good state where integrity becomes self-reinforcing. So, you know, we kind of know what we need to do. What we really need to figure out are what are the circumstances, the political and social circumstances in which we actually see the kind of configuration of political forces that leads to sustained efforts to actually do these things that we kind of know we're supposed to do.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us here on the Scholar Circle, Miriam Golden and Matthew Stevenson. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matthew Stevenson is professor of law at Harvard Law School. He's the author of Legislation and Regulation and the book chapter Corruption and Democratic Institutions, A Review and Synthesis. Miriam Golden is professor of political science at UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles. She's the author of Heroic Defeats, The Politics of Job Loss, and she's co-author of Corruption, What Everybody Needs to Know. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.